said excitedly.
It's a ship made of clouds.
The cloud ship, sailing through the water, was not as close as it first appeared. Its enormous size made it seem that way, growing bigger and bigger in their vision as it approached. It was proportioned like an ocean liner, crafted from fluffy white clouds. Sunset shades of blue and orange delineated the dimensions of the ship that floated over the water at a goodly speed, in spite of no visible propulsion.
That's some proper fantasy world goodness right there, Jason said.
By the time it pulled into place at the dock, it was clear how overwhelmingly humongous the vessel was. Over 300 meters long, 60 meters wide and high, even the silver anchors were agog at the sheer magnitude of it. The ship drew to a gentle stop in the dock, and a walkway of cloud emerged from the side. When it connected to the shore, a hole appeared in the side of the ship to reveal Emir Bahadir. Though he was seeing him in daylight, he looked the same as when Jason had met him in the dark. Sleek clothes, midnight skin, and dark woven hair with colourful beads. Jason had been uncertain in their previous encounter, when Bahadir could seemingly evade his ability to see through darkness. He walked across the platform to the shore, meeting Elspeth Arella, who came out to greet him. She led him inside to be met by the assembled welcoming party, but Clive was uninterested. He had stood up out of his chair, his eyes roaming the side of the ship. His vision power allowed him to see at least some of the otherwise invisible magic.
"This is amazing," he said.
Gabrielle had remained with them to watch the ship appear, and suddenly remembered she should be with the larger group. She was about to hurry away when Bahadir vanished from where he was standing to appear in front of them in a single step.
"Mr. Asano," Emir greeted.
"Mr. Bahadir," Jason said, standing up to shake hands. "This is Gabrielle Pellin. You'll know Danielle Geller, I presume. Gabrielle is currently attached to her son, Humphrey. She does have accomplishments outside what man she's hanging around, but she called me a dimension-hopping loon, so I won't bother with them."
"A delight to meet you," Emir said.
Gabrielle's eyes shot daggers at Jason, before turning back to Emir with a smile.
"A pleasure," she said, shaking his hand. "I am an acolyte with the Church of Knowledge."
"He knows that from your robes," Jason said. "You might as well have worn a white sack and painted Church of Knowledge on it."
"You will pay for this, Jason," she said.
"Facing up to consequences is the making of a man," Jason said, gesturing to Clive, still looking out the window. "This is Clive. He's the deputy something-something of the local magic society, and more interested in your boat than meeting a gold ranker, it appears."
"What?"
Clive said, turning his gaze from the boat for the first time.
"Oh, wait. A gold ranker?"
"Emir Bahadir," Jason introduced. "Meet Clive Standish."
"I'll see you get a tour," Emir said, shaking a flummoxed Clive's hand. "It won't be a ship anymore, but I'm confident you'll find it just as impressive."
"It won't be a boat?"
Clive asked. As they chatted, more people had come across the wide gangplank made of cloud.
"My staff," Emir said. "The ship can be crewed by only a few people, as you will come to see, Clive, but I have various other needs. There seems to be some necessary social duties planned, so I will have to go back. But first..."
The people finished disembarking, around 50 of them.
"Come along," Emir said, and walked back outside, Jason and the others trailing behind.
As they swept past the nonplussed welcoming committee, Gabrielle glanced nervously at her high priest, who nodded the affirmation to continue. Outside, Emir's staff was gathered haphazardly. They were a wild collection of races and ethnicities within those races. Their attire ranged from neat and subdued, like Emir and Rufus preferred, to the wild and colourful clothing that Gary and the Greenstone locals preferred. Emir walked over to a woman dressed in a similar style to himself, with a one-button jacket, neat slacks, and practical dark shoes. Where Emir was dark-skinned, she was pale. Her dark brown hair dropped simply down to neck length in a cut that, like her clothes, was simple and stylish. She had a subdued but not wholly restrained silver rank aura.
"This is Constance," Emir introduced. "She is the single most indispensable person in my world. Constance, this is Jason, Gabrielle, and Clive." They are always welcome. Constance nodded.
Understood. Jason sensed something of a kindred spirit in Amir's easy persona, which he knew had strengths and weaknesses. The professionalism he read in Constance gave him a sense that she was the one who kept the clocks running.
Everyone's off? Amir asked Constance.
They are.
All right, then, Amir said, reaching into his jacket. From it, he pulled what looked to Jason like a round-bottomed chemistry flask, with Amir holding it by the neck. It was certainly too large to fit in a pocket.
Is that a dimensional jacket? Jason asked.
It is, Amir said. Stylish and practical, Jason said. I like it. If you ever find your way to Vitesse, Amir said, I'll introduce you to my tailor. He only takes new clients by referral.
Amir shook the flask, then took out the crystal stopper.
Four thin streams of mist emerged, gathering in the air to form four shapes that floated in place.
Like the ship, they were made of clouds with sunset colors giving definition. One looked like a model of a sprawling estate house, the next like a bus or recreational vehicle with no wheels. The third was a sprawling palace, and the fourth was a small replica of the ship floating in front of them. The final image was glowing with an internal light.
Amir pushed his hand into the image of the palace, which started to glow as the light in the ship faded. After a few moments, the cloud images streamed back into the bottle, and Amir put it away. The sheer magic power of the ship gave it a potent gold-rank aura, and Jason felt that aura start undergoing a shift.
I need to get back to my welcoming party, Amir said. But I think you might enjoy staying to watch. The transformation is something to see.
Amir held out his elbow for Gabrielle.
Care to join me, young lady?
Certainly, she said, and they departed.
Left behind with Amir's staff, they watched as the huge ship morphed into a palace of clouds floating on the water. It took around 10 minutes, which was, as promised, quite something to see. It was even more so to Clive, who could see some of the magic as it transformed.
This is crazy, Clive said. I can barely understand what's happening with these gold-rank processors, but just that little is amazing. Mostly I'm just seeing the structural changes, with the external security measures stopping me from looking deeper, but even that much is incredible.
Security measures? Jason asked.
Oh yes, Clive said. I would very much advise against trying to get in uninvited. It'd be harder to break into than...
Jason looked at Clive after he trailed off. Clive was no longer focused on the transforming ship, instead taking up what Jason recognized as his thinking pose. His eyes were closed, his expression stern. His hands were held loosely in front of him, fingers waggling. Jason watched, waiting quietly until the fingers stopped moving, and Clive opened his eyes, nodding.
That adds up, he said absently to himself,
then turned to Jason.
I know what the thief is after.
Chapter 102. You Fight Like Me. In Old City, the wealthiest area was the Canal District. Once the home of aristocratic power, migration to the island left it open for those who ruled Old City with money and power. It was strictly neutral territory for the Big Three, due to a preponderance of island interests based around the canals and water trade flowing in from the delta. In a less used area of the canal docks was a cluster of buildings, not well placed and too small to service the water traffic that had built up in the years since their construction. Mostly the buildings were used to store items that were rarely, if ever, used. One housed small watercraft awaiting repairs that never came, the cluttered space untouched for years, or so it seemed. Sophie had judiciously placed some of the clutter and quietly moved the rest to the other buildings. Add in some rituals by Belinda to muffle noise and display some simple, static illusions, and the seemingly abandoned building had become a well-hidden lair. Belinda quietly made her way inside, where Sophie was already waiting.
The last item on our shopping list just came up, Belinda said without preamble. We need to move fast, though.
Good, Sophie said. It was getting about time to do another distraction job, or Ventress would call open season on us.
Now we don't have to,
Once we have the tilting stones, we'll have everything we need for the last job.
And we'll finally get out of the city, Sophie said, shoulders slumping wearily.
How's the preparation for that?
I've got maps and supplies enough to get us through the Delta, into the Veldt, and then south to Hornus, Sophie said. After hitting the Spirit Coin Vault, we'll have enough money to buy our way past any influence the Big Three have there and leave this whole continent behind.
Let's not go making assumptions until we're on open ocean, Belinda cautioned. We have two jobs and a long journey between us and there. We have to move fast on this next one.
Tell me.
There's some big project out in the Delta, some ancient ruin or something. The Magic Society was crawling all over it until some out-of-towners showed up and took over.
Out-of-towners?
They arrived on a ship made of clouds, if you can believe that.
A ship made of clouds.
Sounds incredible, right?
Sounds made up.
Nope, Belinda said. The ship turned into a cloud palace and is floating off the north end of the island. I've seen it for myself. It's so big you can spot it from any rooftop on the north side of the city.
Please tell me you don't want us to rob it.
No, Belinda said with a laugh. That ruin they're excavating, it was originally a Magic Society project that these people took over.
That's some serious clout.
Yes, it is. The important part is that the Magic Society is still providing supplies and support. One of the things on the supply list is the tilting stones we need. I'll be getting a heads up when they're scheduled to move, but it'll be sometime next week. We grab the stones during transit.
That's not a lot of time to prepare, Sophie said.
We shouldn't need it. The supply shipments move out from the supply complex at the Magic Society campus with minimal protection. The shipment isn't high value, so they don't have a heavy guard until the Duke's guards meet them at the bridge to Old City.
If it's not high value, then couldn't we just have bought these tilting stones we need?
They're restricted, Belinda explained.
Not dangerous, but they have some specific uses in certain activities. Like the one we want them for.
Exactly.
So we hit it on the island.
Exactly. All the supplies will be in dimensional storage crates. You just need to grab the right crate and get out.
You have the route?
Yeah.
All right then, Sophie said. Let's go scout some locations.
One of the largest and busiest areas of the Magic Society campus was the Magical Supply Complex. In addition to the space requirements, operations were complicated by the sometimes volatile nature of magical materials. Care had to be taken to store various goods correctly while keeping apart materials that would affect one another in proximity. This caused a number of fundamental problems for the smooth running of the supply complex. The first problem was structural. Purpose-designed, the complex was a nest of interconnected buildings, linked by secured walkways at ground level and above. There were warehouse structures, towers, domes, and in one case, a spherical building secured by a cubic frame of support struts. Storage and record-keeping were even more of a mess. Because of the nature of the stored materials, magical requirements took precedence over the practical requirements of space efficiency. This, in turn, made inventory management and supply a nightmare. In the central loading and distribution center, the supply manager was named Thel, and the distribution manager, Drew. They were having several busy weeks at a run. First, the Magic Society started up some operation out in the middle of a swamp, which was already a logistical nightmare. Then the whole thing was taken over by some out-of-town group. The Society was still giving logistical support and supply, which meant meeting the different needs of the new group while adding a whole extra layer to supply management because they weren't Magic Society. Amid a busy day, Thel brought out a new supply order to give to Drew.
This just came in from the big building, she told Drew.
The big building was what they called central administration, out of which the Magic Society officials operated.
Great, Drew said, as he unenthusiastically took the paper with the supply order and read it over. One more idiot who doesn't think twice about messing up our schedules.
He glanced at the authorizing officer box on the order to see who dumped it on him.
Adjunct assistant to the deputy director of the Magic Society, Greenstone Branch, he read. What in the God's names does that mean?
Sounds like a position that was made up for some rich prick's useless kid, Thel said.
Doesn't it just?
This one's a little odd, Thel said, gesturing at the order. The guy who delivered the order said he was told to be very clear it was a low priority order.
Low priority?
That's right. He said he was given specific instructions that we don't break schedule and just fit it in when we can. He just wants us to let him know when it's going out.
That's weird, right?
Very weird. I've seen plenty of demands from the high-ups to rush an order, but being told to take our time is a first.
Sounds shady, Drew said. Since when did you see anyone with authority show any consideration or decency?
Never, Fel said. Think we should look into it?
Gods no. The order isn't a do-up, is it?
No, the order's for real.
Then it's not our problem. We get the piece of paper and we do what it says. Anything more than that is someone else's problem.
Jason and Clive were walking through Old City, in the direction of Jory's clinic.
Are you sure just organizing the shipment was enough? Clive asked. Maybe I should have leaked some more information.
No, Jason said. This thief clearly has solid information sources. If she kept hearing about the shipment from too many places, she'd get spooked and not take the bait. As long as you made sure the shipment won't move out until they've had time to hear about it. You're sure this is what she needs, right? These tilting stones?
Jason, I'm one of the few people with a complete understanding of the security measures around the city's spirit coin vault. Once we scratch the distraction items off our list, everything she's stolen as part of this spree can be used to circumvent one of those security measures. Bronze rank sober gas for the guards, sump coil rods for the alarm matrix, dodec crystals for the vault door.
The magic 12-sided dice? Jason said. They're my favorite.
I don't know how this thief got such a complete rundown of the security, but looking at what she's been stealing, she clearly has it.
And you're worried she won't find out about the shipment?
That's a good point.
You just have to swap us out for the regular drivers at the very last minute so she doesn't catch wind.
They went in through the new self-opening glass doors of the clinic.
Nice, Clive said, looking them over as they went through. That's some clean, simple magic.
They were my suggestion, Jason said. They walked up to the receptionist.
Morning, Janice, Jason greeted her.
Can he spare a minute?
For you, Mr. Asano, always. Things have been a lot more manageable since the initial rush, and having a healing priest here full-time really makes things easier. We miss having you around, though. You're always off having exciting adventures these days. I'm surprised you aren't on that big expedition everyone was talking about.
They need someone to keep things running while everyone else is gallivanting about, Jason said. You haven't met Clive yet, have you? They chatted, waiting for Jory, but a different person emerged instead. It was a runic, with the dark skin and glowing runes typical of his people.
Mr. Lange, Janice greeted and made introductions.
Donald Lange was the priest of the healer assigned to Jory's clinic for the moment. He had arrived in Greenstone through a portal created by the healer to help replace the excommunicated clergy.
Jory has good things to say about you, Mr. Asano. Confusing and contradictory at times, but with much praise. Healing people for nothing is a fine calling, although I may be biased in that opinion.
Don't go praising me too much, Jason said. It was an easy way to train my cleansing power, so it wasn't exactly selfless.
Jason, Jory said, entering the waiting room. Come on back.
Jason and Clive shook hands with Donald, then followed Jory. In one of the back rooms, Jason quickly got to the point. I need something that can change our faces and something that can mask our auras. Knock it down to normal rank if possible. Jory rubbed his chin, thoughtfully.
Changing your face is easy enough, he said. Frankly, I'm surprised it took you this long to ask.
What's wrong with my face?
I've had some reports that the face-changing ointment is a bit unreliable, Jory said, ignoring Jason's question. Moving your face reduces the effective duration, so try not to talk and keep your expression blank as much as you can.
That should be fine, Clive said, Jason nodding agreement.
Changing your aura is trickier, Jory said. If you just wanted to mask it at your own rank, that would be one thing. I could give you something for that now. Dropping it down a rank is another matter. This is for a contract.
It is, Jason said. Clive and I have been working this one for a little while.
I heard you're a big 3-star adventurer now, Jory said.
How did you swing that?
With your watering can and a little discretion, Jason said, causing Jory to laugh. That makes sense, he said. They must have been so startled to see discretion from you that they handed over the star from sheer startlement. Clive burst out laughing.
I'm starting to feel put upon, Jason said. Can you help with the aura?
I think I can make up what you need, Jory said. It'll be precarious, though. How's your aura control?
It's coming along.
It'll have to be. If you can't keep it suppressed, it'll breach the aura mask, so will using any essence abilities.
That's fine, Jason said. It's just an extra precaution that Clive suggested.
Our quarry is cautious and resourceful, Clive said.
Probably best not to share any unnecessary details, Jason said to Clive.
He's right, Jory said. I can't spill porridge that's not in my bowl. I can have that for you tomorrow, or tonight, if you're really in a rush.
Tomorrow is fine, Clive said.
We'll let you get back to it, Jason said. How are those Church of the Healer people working out?
Fantastic, Jory said. Mostly it's been Donald, and he's terrific. It's like having you on full time, without the ominous overtones. Oh, before you go, Narch loved that barbecue you had. It drummed him up a whole lot of business. He wanted me to ask you if you had any interest in doing it on the regular. Your connections, his booze.
Norwich, Clive asked. Was he the guy running the bar?
That's right, Jory said. He has a distillery a couple of streets over.
That's not a terrible idea, Jason said. I'm a little busy just right now, but tell him I'm interested.
A wagon was making its way through the streets of the island. It had no animals pulling it. It was being driven by magic. There was a driver, plus another man next to him on the driver's bench. In the early afternoon, there were people out and about. It remained uncrowded, though, with the wide streets and generous footpaths. The men on the wagon didn't even glance as it rolled past a young woman with short hair, wearing a light jacket over a dress decorated with dark flowers. After the wagon passed her by, Belinda opened her jacket to look at the crystal plate sewn into it. It showed the aura of the wagon's dimensional storage crates and the normal rank auras of the two men riding it. She took a small tube from her jacket pocket, holding it vertically as she peeled a paper cap off the top. She felt a blast of heat and air, but the magical flare would be invisible and silent to anyone without a special viewing item or certain essence abilities. Another of the island streets had a row of trees planted down the middle of the two-lane thoroughfare. Sophie had been hidden in the upper branches of one of the trees since before dawn. She was dressed in shades of dark green to blend into the foliage. The clothing was the ideal balance of fitted and loose to provide optimum mobility, but their protective value suffered somewhat. When she saw the flare rise into the sky, Sophie took off the spectacles that allowed her to see it and put them in a case, which she returned to a pocket. Shortly after, a wagon passed under the branch she was perched on, and she dropped down behind it, barely making a sound as she landed in a crouch on the street. She moved swiftly, clambering over the back of the covered wagon. It was filled with metal crates, just as promised, and she quickly found the one with the marking she was looking for. When she grabbed it, though, a rune appeared, and explosive force blasted her out of the back of the wagon as it activated. She rolled on the ground, head spinning. By the time she recovered, the wagon had stopped, and the two men on it had gotten off and were rushing towards her. She hopped quickly to her feet, just as the first one reached her. She lashed out with a series of attacks, but every move in her flurry of blows was blocked. He looked as surprised as she felt.
You fight like me, he said.
She didn't respond and resumed her attack. She had never met anyone who knew her father's fighting style before, but she adapted quickly. After a rapid exchange, she winded him with a palm strike to the torso and sent him tumbling with a kick to the side of the head. She was moving before he hit the ground, sprinting for the wall of a nearby property. She zigzagged her movement, not presenting an easy shot, which proved wise as a bolt of magic shot past her. A glowing rune appeared in her path, and she neatly sidestepped it, almost having reached the wall. Behind her, she heard a spell being chanted.
Carry the mark of your transgressions.
Sophie felt a burning on the side of her face, but didn't let it slow her down. She reached the wall and ran up it as if it were flat ground. Reaching the top, she pulled herself over and out of sight. Chapter 103 Silver Hair.
Sophie vaulted a wall from one private residence into another, sprinting across the grounds. She did this twice more, avoiding public streets and the people on them. Finally, she ducked into a large brick shed full of landscaping supplies. Jason chased after Sophie, relying not on his eyes, but his aura sense. One of the afflictions he marked her with made her aura radiate like a beacon.
Mark of sin, affliction, holy, prevents aura retraction, cannot be cleansed while target retains any instances of sin or legacy of sin.
Using weight reduction to vault walls, he pursued until her aura suddenly vanished. He didn't have an exact lock on her location, so was forced to start searching around.
"Excuse me?"
An affronted voice came in Jason's direction. He flashed his adventure badge to the angry resident.
"Adventure Society business, sir." "Is this to do with the person who just ran across my lawn?"
"It certainly is," Jason said. "I don't suppose you could point out the direction they went?"
"Gladly,"
the man said.
"What's that on your face?"
Belinda asked. She had cleared a space on a bench in the shed, now covered in magical tools.
"Not sure," Sophie said. "Some kind of tracking magic, probably."
Belinda moved close to examine it. It looked like a word from a symbolic language she didn't know. She picked up a thin metal rod, waving it in front of Sophie's face.
"Not tracking,"
she said, swapping the rod for a small plate made up of crystal fragments. She looked at what appeared when she held it in front of Sophie.
"It looks like it forcibly projects your aura," Belinda said. "Not bad as a tracker, but I don't have anything here that can deal with it, the way I could with tracking magic. With this, aura masking won't work and disguises won't be much better. You'll stick out like a turd in a punch bowl to anyone with aura sense."
"Good thing we're here on the island where all the people with aura senses are."
"The protection I set up in here will hide your aura so long as you're in this shed. But you can't stay here. The usual trick of blending into the crowd won't work with your aura like that."
"Any good news?"
Sophie asked.
"Unlike a tracker, you can only be followed so long as you remain within their aura sense. If you can outrun them and get to our fallback point, we can take our time with whatever this thing is affecting your aura, and no one can run like you."
Sophie nodded, regret on her face.
"I didn't get it," she said.
Belinda put a reassuring hand on Sophie's shoulder.
"One step at a time. We can work on what comes next after we get ourselves out of this mess. Now you need to go."
"You need to be careful too.
My aura isn't shining like a beacon in the night, remember? You play distraction, and I'll slip away."
Bloody hell, she's fast. Jason had sensed it the moment the thief's aura re-emerged, and he immediately gave chase. He caught sight of her sprinting through other people's properties. They were in the North Marina District, which had the Broad Street Bridge to Old City, marinas on the island's eastern shore, and was otherwise mostly private residences. The thief moved incredibly fast on the ground, the walls and hedges barely slowing her down. Her mottled green clothing covered her entirely, with even her head wrapped up like a ninja. If he didn't have her aura to track, she could probably vanish into one of the gardens she was passing through. He was unable to match her speed. In the end, he resorted to a desperation move. The bright sun cast large shadows from the uniformly big houses. This allowed Jason to shadow jump into the air, three stories up, next to a wall. Spotting the thief, he teleported to the shadow of the next building, then the next. With the combination of weight-reduced floating and shadow teleporting, he pursued in something of an awkward flight. The thief was making a beeline for the marina. She crossed the busy esplanade at a sprint, startling passers-by. Jason teleported onto the covered balcony of the yacht club, but it was the last of the easy shadows. He watched the thief pelt down the pier faster than he could match, until she reached the end and vaulted onto the water. She landed on the surface like it was solid ground and kept running. Jason could likewise walk on water, but by the time he chased her across to Old City, her speed would have left him behind. He ran to the edge of the balcony and looked around for options. "Well, there's that," he told himself. Using the parkour skills Gary had taught him, he jumped out to grab the edge of the roof and pull himself on top of the building. He was grateful for the ostentatious size of the four-story yacht club, which gave him a high vantage. He glanced down at the figure sprinting across the water, then up at the opposite shore, some 2 kilometers distant. When he was still training, he had conducted various long-distance teleporting experiments. The key seemed to be seeing a shadow to teleport to. Teleporting to the shadow of a large, distant object didn't work, as his ability required a more discreet shadow to use as a portal. He tried magnifying items to pick out a distant shadow, but viewing through these magical devices made him unable to form a connection with the distant shadow. In the end, since he couldn't find one to purchase, Jason commissioned a craftsman to make a high-quality, non-magical telescope. The unusual request had taken time. However, and by the time it was completed, Jason was living the busy life of an adventurer. As such, he'd picked up the item and left it in his inventory with the 10-foot pole, the rope ladder, and his various other pieces of adventuring kit. "No time like the present," he said, pulling out the telescope. It truly was a fine piece of craftsmanship, but he didn't stop to admire it, putting it directly to his eye. First, he picked out the thief, moving across the water. Once he spied where she was heading, he looked to the far shore in search of a shadow. Clive looked around the interior of the brick shed. His ability to see magic let him pick out what were the otherwise invisible magical marks, drawn onto the bricks of the wall to shield it from magical detection. It had taken him time to seek out, using flaring rituals to find the magical dead spot. If Jason hadn't told him the right area through his voice communication power, he likely wouldn't have found it at all. Examining the work, he saw the principles involved were basic, making use of fundamental magical theory. The application, however, showed a comprehensive understanding and was highly innovative in execution. If it weren't for criminal purposes to which it had been put, he would admire it. "Who am I kidding?" he asked the empty shed. "I do admire it." The shed clearly didn't see a lot of use. Almost everything had a thick layer of dust, except a section of the bench and a pair of stools. Jason and Clive had considered whether or not the thief had one or more accomplices. It seemed she did. Whoever this accomplice was, they had taken their tools but didn't have time to clear off their magical workings. Presumably, they were relying on the magic being invisible and the distraction of the fleeing thief. That left Clive with a good chance to extract an aura trace from the magic. Moving outside, he balanced out the ambient magic with his mana equilibrium racial gift, then took out a book and used his enact ritual essence ability to start placing a magical circle around the shed. A line of shining gold energy appeared where his finger pointed as he drew out a sophisticated circle, referencing the book as he went.
"What are you doing on my lawn?" an affronted voice called out.
"Adventure Society business," Clive said, not looking away from his work.
"Again? Who do you people think you are?"
"I'm adjunct assistant to the deputy director of the Magic Society, Greenstone Branch," Clive said.
"Is that something important?"
the man asked uncertainly.
"Do you really want to find out?"
The magical circle completed. From inside the shed, the previously invisible magic lit up in blue and red. A vaguely human image appeared, flickering in and out in the middle of Clive's circle. Clive took a tracking stone from his storage space and shoved it into the middle of the image. The image was drawn into the stone, like being sucked into a void. The gold light of Clive's ritual and the red and blue from the shed then dimmed to nothing. Clive looked at the tracking stone in his hand, which now had an internal light pointing in a very definite direction.
"Got you."
Sophie's solitary essence ability made her fast, and by spending mana, she could run up walls or over water. The breakwaters at each end of the strait between Old City and the island made the space between calm and easy to run over. Reaching the Old City port, she ran right up the side of the dock and onto dry ground. For a fleeting moment, she thought she was free and clear. Then she saw a shadowy figure standing in her path. The person was shrouded in what looked like the night sky, not just black but dark and deep, with distant stars twinkling within. Under the cloak were dark, flowing robes, with a sword on one hip and a dagger on the other. A bandolier with what looked like throwing knives went from left shoulder to right hip. The port was busy, as always, and the two unusual figures staring each other down caught the attention of the dock workers. Sophie looked around as people quickly gathered.
"Don't make me go through you," she told the dark figure.
"Don't make me use my abilities," the figure said. "They're for killing, not catching."
It was the same voice as the person who ambushed her when she tried to rob the wagon. The one who fought like her.
She launched herself forward, confident that she was better. They clashed, then broke away inconclusively. This repeated a second time and a third. She was landing hits, but nothing conclusive. She absently noted that the dock workers had started taking bets. Their fighting styles were the same, but they used them very differently. She was all speed and efficiency, using the versatility of the style to adapt and pressure opponents. He was deceptive and manipulative, seemingly full of openings, but more than once she thought she almost had him, only to realize it was just the opposite. He also used his cloak to mask his movements, making him hard to read. She had some near misses, but the more she pressured him, the more she figured him out. His methods were dangerous, but he didn't have a complete handle on them yet. So long as she was cautious and stuck to fundamentals, she knew she could take him down. So, apparently, did he. He withdrew the dagger from his belt. The bone blade, with its slight curve, made it look like a fang. It was almost certainly magical. She drew the knife strapped to her thigh. Not magical, but well-crafted. "We can still end this here," he said. He sounded earnest, but resigned. She lunged again. A knife fight was a messy business. Fast hands, fast blades, too quick to intercept. Even against an amateur, accepting a knife fight meant accepting wounds, if only superficial ones. The difference in outcome between Sophie and the shadowy man was a matter of equipment. Her knife slid off his thin but strong cloth armor, while his knife cut through her camouflage clothes to leave shallow cuts on her arms as she used them to guard more vital points. Breaking off again, she realized he wasn't even going for real hits, satisfied to inflict minor injuries. Either his dagger or his abilities likely inflicted poison. "Now you see your situation," the man said, having noticed her realization as she looked at her wounds. "Your choices now are to come with me or die." Sophie glanced back, considering leaping back off the dock. In her moment of distraction, he made the first move for the first time in their confrontation. She evaded, but his free hand grabbed at her. She slipped away, but his fingers closed on her mask, pulling it free. As her silver hair spilled out, he saw her face. His own was hidden in the hood of the cloak, although she had seen it back at the wagon. The situation suddenly shifted as a half dozen people broke through the circle of onlookers. They were dressed all in black, with masks like she had been wearing. The shadowy figure said a word she didn't recognize and was immediately attacked. She took the opportunity and ran. Even as he fought off these new opponents, she heard him chant an ominous spell behind her. "Your fate is to suffer." Belinda was in line at the Broad Street Bridge, waiting to hand over her permit before crossing to Old City. In both dress and manner, she was indistinguishable from the many servants likewise heading to Old City on household errands. She noticed a slight commotion in the line, looking back to see a man walking down the line, looking at something in his hand. He was tall and lanky, with the uniform of a Magic Society functionary. The men on the wagon Sophie had attempted to rob had the same uniforms, but this wasn't one of those men, unless they changed their faces with magic. Sophie and herself had tried that from time to time, but it was unreliable and prone to wearing off early. Belinda couldn't run like Sophie, and had always relied on secrecy and deception. Even if she could, there wasn't much place to run. The Duke's guards manning the crossing booth might be casual to those departing the island, but that would quickly change if she made a break for it. The best she could do was keep in character and hope that the man was trying to flush people out with security theater. Her hopes were dashed when the man stopped right in front of her. Jason was startled to see silver hair spill out, forming a corona around the thief's dark beauty. He froze in that fleeting moment, recognizing her as Jory's Celestine friend. She also froze, looking cornered as her eyes darted around. Then out of nowhere, a group of attackers came barreling at Jason, dressed head to toe in black. "Ninjas?" he said, and they were on him. He evaded, but the Celestine took the chance to run. He had to send her where he knew he could find her. "Your fate is to suffer." She would have to run to Jory if she wanted to stay alive, but casting the spell cost Jason as he was overrun by attackers. They dropped him to the ground and gathered over him, laying in kicks. Jason evened the odds, and then some, by sending a geyser of leeches spraying up into them. The attackers reeled, screaming as they pulled off leeches, who took gobbets of flesh with them in rings of burrowing teeth. The watching dock workers backed off, but not so much that they couldn't keep watching. Jason got to his feet and held out a hand at one of the men yanking leeches off his body.
"Your blood is not yours to keep, but mine on which to feast."
Jason siphoned off the man's life force to heal the beating they had got in. They all had essences, but he could tell from their auras that none had a full set.
"You won't survive long if you don't tell me who sent you," he told them.
"You can kill us," one of them said, "but the man who sent us will kill our whole families."
Jason frowned at that.
"Encircle," he commanded.
The leeches dropped off the men to form a ring around them. They were all bleeding and poisoned, but Jason used his Feast of Absolution power on each in turn. It replenished his mana and kept them alive. They would probably survive one bleed affliction. They stood in place, unsure and unsteady. Jason moved forwards and ripped the mask off the one who had spoken. Jason didn't recognize him.
"The person who sent you will kill your family if you talk?"
"That's right," he said, scared, but looking back with defiance. "You might as well let us go. We won't talk, even if you kill us."
"Let you go?" Jason asked. "After you attacked me?"
"If you're not going to talk, then you're no use to me alive."
Jory was seeing out a patient when he heard a crashing sound from the back room and rushed back there. Donal, the priest of the healer, was likewise coming to check the commotion. Together, they found a woman who had apparently staggered in the back and knocked over a rack of alchemy implements as she collapsed. She now lay amongst shattered glass.
"Silver hair," Donal said. "A Celestine."
Jory's troubled expression got worse when they turned her over, and it was, as he feared, Sophie Wexler. They picked her up out of the glass and carried her into one of the new treatment rooms, laying her out on the examination table. Seeing darkened flesh under the rips in her clothes, Jory cut away her outer garment, revealing a tight sleeveless top and cuts on the arms that weren't from the broken glass. Ominous black veins traced out from each of the wounds, clearly visible through the skin. The wounds themselves were already showing signs of necrosis.
"Some kind of necrotic poison," Jory said.
Donald was already chanting a spell.
"Make clean that which has been tainted."
The black veins retreated somewhat, but then visibly started crawling up her arms once again.
"It's like the poison is replicating itself," Donald said.
"I'll work on the poison," Jory said. "You stop it from killing her. If we can beat it back enough, you can try a longer spell."
Jory started grabbing supplies from cabinets as Donald chanted another spell.
"You're not going to kill us in front of all these people,"
one of Jason's attackers said.
"Are you kidding?" one of the others asked. "Look at that cloak. He's the cloak guy."
"What the hell are you talking about?"
the first attacker asked.
"The one who killed 5 adventurers in a shopping arcade in the middle of the day,"
the second attacker said.
"Not just regular people, but actual adventurers. And you know what they did to him? They promoted him. You think he won't kill us because some dock workers saw it?"
Jason, taking in the exchange, turned to the second attacker.
"You seem to know a lot," Jason said, walking over and pulling off the man's mask.
"You won't tell me who sent you?"
"I can't."
"Then tell me why. That's your live or die question."
"I don't know," the man said, voice almost begging. "I really don't. We were just meant to slow you down and run, like with the others."
"Shut up, Jacob,"
one of the others barked. Jason pointed at the man who spoke. "Mount," he ordered. And the leeches crawled up the man's legs and over his body, but did not yet sink their teeth into him. Then Jason turned back to Jacob. "By others, you mean the other adventurers trying to catch the thief?" The man nodded, and Jason started pacing as his brain ticked over. The now terrified attackers watched, unmoving, as they awaited their fate with bated breath.
"How did you know to intercept me here?" "Keep your mouth shut, Jacob."
"Screw you guys.
I don't have a family, and I ain't getting eaten by leeches. There's some silver ranker tracking the thief. Abilities too high for the thief's friend to spot.
That would be the one Jory has a thing for, Jason realized. Go on, Jason said.
That's all I know. He tracks the thief, then we get a signal and a location if we have to intervene. I don't even know why they bother with us if they have someone like that.
To keep it low-key, Jason said absently. Who do you work for?
What I told you already gets me hurt, Jacob said. Telling you that gets me killed.
I know that guy, one of the dock workers called out. Jason turned and flipped him a bronze spirit coin.
Jack Jumper Jacob, the dock worker said. He's one of Dorgan's.
Jason didn't know more than the basics about the big three. Dorgan was the quiet one, while the ambitious Ventress and the impetuous Silver worked their schemes against one another.
Things are coming together, Jason said absently, but there's a connection missing.
That's enough, Asano,
a harsh voice said. A man approached through the crowd of dock workers. He was human, with well-made sandy-colored clothes. Jason could sense no aura, but the workers instinctively moved out of his way. Jason was willing to bet the aura he couldn't sense was silver.
Your quarry has escaped, the newcomer said. And you've got all you're getting out of these men. Time to give up and try another day, Asano.
Jason tuttered.
She won't be happy you had to show up in person, he said.
The silver ranker flinched. Jason chuckled.
Fair enough, Jason said. I have somewhere else to be anyway.
Sophie was unconscious but alive, still on the examination table, but now with a sheet over her. Jory and Donal were exhausted. Donal was sprawled in the room's only chair, while Jory was on the floor, leaning against the wall. On the floor were dozens of empty vials that Jory had used to treat Sophie, or that Donal had emptied to replenish his manor.
It was some kind of curse, Donal said. Two curses, really. One was making the poison worse, while the other was adding more poison to the first curse. The curse that kept making more of the other two couldn't be cleansed until the other curse was cleansed, and she had so much of it in her when she arrived.
Too bad Jason isn't here, Jory said. He'd have eaten it all, like it was nothing.
Eaten?
He can be a little sinister, Jory said, but he's a good man.
I hope you still think so after today, Jason said, from the doorway.
Jason, Jory said, we could have used you here a while ago. Something happened to my friend a while ago. I don't know what, but it was bad.
Jory and Donal pushed themselves to their feet.
Curses and poison, Jason said, looking at Sophie.
Jason was decked out in his adventuring gear, spattered with blood.
Are you chasing what did this to her? Jory asked.
I'm chasing her, Jason said. I am what did this.
Chapter 104. An Outcome That Satisfies.
This is bad, Jory said, pacing back and forth.
That's what they've been doing. Ripping off the rich and powerful.
Jory, Jason, and Donal were in one of Jory's treatment rooms, with an unconscious Sophie on the treatment table. She was mostly covered in a sheet, except for her head. Her silver hair hung off the side of the table in a tangled mess.
Who is this woman? Donal asked.
Donal, Jason said. Janice is probably becoming concerned that no one is taking patients. Can you cover for Jory for a bit?
Do I get an explanation about all this later?
Yes, but I'll probably lie, Jason said.
Thanks for keeping her alive.
Donal frowned, but made his way out.
Lord, you were right about him being trouble,
Jason heard him mutter as he closed the door behind him.
What about Belinda?
Jory asked. Remember my friend Clive? He caught her.
Where is she now?
We set up a discreet location to hold the thief while we figured out the politics. Hang on a bit and I'll check up on her. Jason used his party interface to open voice chat with Clive.
She's trouble, Clive said, his exasperation coming through loud and clear.
Using an old Magic Society storehouse for our makeshift cell may not have been the best idea. The resourceful little minx almost broke out of the binding circle using random magic supplies. That shouldn't even be possible. It's all random, leftover trash.
You said she's resourceful, Jason said.
I caught her decoding a barrier ritual with half of a magic wand and a broken device for assessing the freshness of fish.
I wouldn't have thought there was a lot of crossover between a magic barrier and a fish.
There isn't. This woman is a complete... Hey, put that down. I saw that.
I need you to bring her to Old City, Jason said. That clinic on Broad Street Boulevard we visited the other day, but bring her around the back.
What? Old City? How do I explain to the bridge guards why I'm taking a woman I have in custody to Old City? They'll definitely think I'm going to do something bad.
Yeah, but you're a Magic Society official, so they'll let you through anyway.
What?
Look, Clive, her name is Belinda. Tell her that... Hold on. What's this one's name, Jory?
Sophie, Jory said.
Tell her that Sophie was badly hurt and she's at Jory's clinic.
What else?
Just be honest. I don't think lying's your thing.
Don't I have to lie to the bridge guards?
Yeah, but they'll just think you're nervous because you're a sexual predator.
What?
See you when you get here, Jason said, ending the chat.
What now?
Jory asked, almost jumping on Jason in anxiety.
Obviously, Jason said. I have to turn in Sophie.
Jory opened his mouth to protest, but stopped and nodded reluctantly.
If it ever came out that you completed a contract and then uncompleted it, he said, that's your Adventure Society membership gone. Mine too, for that matter, just for knowing about it.
We do have some room to move, Jason said. For one thing, the contract calls for the capture of a thief, not thieves. We caught them both because we were being thorough, but now we know they're friends, we can cut Belinda loose.
Jory let out a sigh of relief, although he still had stress to spare. I'm having Clive bring Belinda here, Jason explained, because I don't want her running around causing trouble before I have a solid plan in place.
So, what is the plan?
We have to hand Sophie in, Jason said. That's something we just have to accept. I'm going to need you to convince her friend not to do anything stupid. You need to keep them both here without them running, while I fill in the gaps in the political landscape. Once I know how everything fits together, we can work something out.
Like what?
Have you ever read the service agreement between the city and the Adventure Society?
Of course I haven't.
It has some interesting provisions, Jason said. Until I understand the political context, though, I'm stumbling in the dark. When Clive gets here with Belinda, just try and keep a lid on things until I get back.
Get back? Where are you going?
To get some context, Jason said.
Do you know where Dorgan lives?
Dorgan? As in the crime lord Dorgan?
That's the one. Are you insane?
Probably, Jason said. I heard the big three all live pretty large, so it can't be that hard to find.
They all live in the Canal District, Jory said. Safe and neutral territory because of the island interests that operate out of there. I don't think wandering into his compound is a good idea.
Come on, Jory. Where's your sense of adventure?
Where's your sense of self-preservation?
Jory groaned.
Look who I'm asking, he said. The day we met, you picked a fight with a couple of priests and got knocked out cold.
Fine. All of the big three live in huge compounds that used to belong to families who moved to the island. Go to the Cavendish side of the Canal District and look for the big walls with the big guards at the big gate.
Thanks, Jason said. I'll be back soon.
If you live, Jory muttered.
No one knew how physically vast the astral space supplying water to the desert was, as it had never been mapped. The goal of the expedition was to find whatever was causing the apertures to become unreliable. They found the closest stable aperture within the thickest cluster of unstable ones and had gone through. The terrain inside the astral space was tropical rainforest, very beautiful and very wet. There was a smell of life to it, wet leaves and earth. There was no night, the sun just moving around on a circuit in the sky.
The expedition made camp by a river, and the expedition leaders, led by Daniel Geller, set out a search pattern. Multiple teams splitting up to follow streams and trails through the wet, tropical forest. What they found was that they were on one of a sprawling chain of islands, close enough to see one another from shore. Traversing the short distance to the next island was a trivial task, given the assemblage of powers in the expedition. They started systematically searching one island after another, sending out individual teams for the smaller ones. The most difficult aspect of the environment was not the verdant growth or the thick, humid air. It was the endless daylight. As what should have been days passed without the respite of nights, the less disciplined members of the expedition became increasingly disgruntled. Many of the expedition's members had come along not for work, but because they felt it was their right to not miss out. Danielle would not normally accept such a team, full of spoiled incompetents and people who were only adventurers on paper. Elspeth Arella already had a list of participants when she offered leadership to Danielle, whose instincts told her it was a bad bet. She accepted anyway, because when something inevitably went wrong, by being there she could save lives that would be lost if she wasn't. Danielle Geller had laid out a driving schedule to advance their goal, but it was being increasingly spoken out against, largely by the wealthy young iron rankers who were the most novice among the expedition's number. Danielle herself had no time for their complaints. She knew that a problem with the astral space potentially posed an existential threat to the region, and was determined to find it and crush it. Adrus Dorgan's aura sensors weren't as powerful or well-trained as someone like Thalia Mercer's. Where she had detected Jason's when he was still on the grounds, Jason penetrated the heart of Dorgan's home without detection. Dorgan found him in front of one of the many paintings that adorned the library walls. He was dressed in neat casual attire, for all the world, as if home invasion was a simple outing. He didn't turn from the painting as Dorgan made his way across the library. "Mr. Asano, isn't it?" Dorgan said. He recognized the face, having seen it in several recordings. There was the widely disseminated recording of the man fighting the Gellers, and the less widespread one of him beating down thugs in Cavendish. The men in question had each been using a recording crystal. A copy of one had found its way into Dorgan's hands. He had even seen a recording of Asano killing those same men in the largest arcade in Dorgan's own territory. That recording was far from just floating around, yet had still come into Dorgan's possession. "Mr. Dorgan," Jason greeted, turning with a friendly smile and looking him up and down. The elven man was handsome, with slender features, tawny skin, and shoulder-length chestnut hair. There was an air of sharpness about him, although that may have just been his aura. "It's a pleasure to meet you, but I'm a little surprised to find you in my library," Dorgan said. "You know, I was just recently discussing the problem of home security with Thalia Mercer." "Did you break into her home as well?" "More like snuck onto the grounds," Jason said. "No offense, but your people are not the equal of the Mercer household." "I could summon my bronze rankers now," Dorgan said, "or deal with you personally. You realize I'm bronze rank." "I can see that," Jason said. "Not a lot of time to work on aura control with a criminal empire to run." Jason gave him an easy smile. "I recently had a problem," Jason said, "where I was unable to deal with a certain individual due to his connections. Thadwick Mercer." "I'm flattered you're paying attention. You dropped 5 dead adventurers in my territory, Mr. Asano. Not paying attention would be foolish." "That kind of ties in with what I want to say, given that I now find myself on the other side of the privilege coin. If I don't walk out of here, you won't like who comes to ask why." "Are you sure about that? Perhaps I have connections of which you're not aware." Jason laughed and gestured at the painting he was standing in front of. "Before you came in, Mr. Dorgan, I was just admiring your art collection. There is a desert landscape by Moher in the Grand Concert Hall that I very much admire, and I see you have quite a number of his works. I'm envious."
Perhaps I can help you add something to your own collection. He's a friend of the family.
So I've heard, Jason said.
Dorgan stopped cold.
You know, he said, his voice half a whisper.
I do, Jason said. I came here with a question and found the answer hanging on the walls.
Is she your daughter?
I kept it a secret so her future wouldn't be caught up with criminal entanglements, Dorgan said. A father's wish for his child to go further than he.
I can respect that, Jason said. I have no interest in telling tales. I came here to find out why your people were interfering with my contract.
I believe it's an open contract, Mr. Asano. I'm closing it, which makes it mine.
You caught the thief?
Of course. When your men intervened, I sent her where I knew I could find her.
How did you manage that?
In an unpleasant manner. But sometimes life requires unpleasant things.
Doesn't it just? Dorgan said. It seems you're a resourceful man, Mr. Asano.
Thank you. My problem is that I don't quite grasp the entirety of the political landscape. I obviously understand the connection with your daughter now, but what is she after in keeping the thief at large? It seems like she wants a point of contention between her and the Duke, but that's a stupid move and she's not stupid. She's taking risks, which is the only reason she was sloppy enough that I found out about you and her.
What are the chances of someone visiting her office and my house both? Dorgan asked.
Not high.
The paintings in your daughter's office didn't bring me here, Jason said. They just made it easy for me once they arrived. Anyone who really looked at the connections would figure it out soon enough.
I don't know about anyone.
What is she after, Dorgan?
Why does that matter?
Because I have my own concerns. I don't want her squashing me like a bug because I ignorantly blundered underfoot.
Dorgan nodded.
Very well, he said. Her goal is Lucian Lamprey.
The director of the Magic Society?
Jason rubbed his chin thoughtfully.
I've heard he's a crate full of rotten eggs, Jason said, which explains why she wants him gone. Having a corrupt magic society makes cleaning up the Adventure Society all the harder.
But what's Lamprey's connection with this thief?
He's fixated on her. He's the kind of man who sees being told no as a challenge to his power, and he's become obsessed with possessing this woman. She is ostensibly under the protection of Clarissa Ventress, one of my peers, but Ventress has her own well-known obsession, her reputation. As she made it known the girl was under her protection, she couldn't just hand her over. Instead, she has leveraged the girl into a position where she would fall into Lamprey's hands.
So he's a perv, Jason said. That's why the thief was hitting such insanely dangerous targets. Ventress was pushing her into it, under threat of withdrawing her protection. If she refuses, Ventress can throw her to the wolves, and if she's caught, Lamprey can throw his weight around with the inevitably corrupt civic justice system.
Yes, Dorgan said. That's my understanding.
Ventress never expected it to take this long to catch her, Jason reasoned. Meanwhile, Lamprey is climbing the walls while your daughter waits for him to do something stupid she can hang him out to dry with.
Yes, Dorgan said. I don't suppose I can convince you to let the thief go.
And hand you a great big lever on me?
No thanks.
Besides, if I let her go, then my ability to control how this ends goes with her.
You think that's something you can control?
Enough for an outcome that satisfies me, yes.
You may be overestimating your limits, Mr. Asano.
I have a friend who says pushing our limits is how we grow beyond them.
Then what now? Dorgan asked.
Now I complete the contract. I'm sorry it will interfere with your daughter's plans, but she really should be thanking me.
It had far too many potential failure points.
You aren't going to ask why the daughter of a crime lord is trying to excise corruption from the Adventure Society?
That's obvious, Jason said. She gets rid of Lamprey and the Magic Society becomes less corrupt because almost anything would be. She moves on to smoothly cleaning up her branch of the Adventure Society. She culminates that time by capping it off with the renegotiation of the city's service agreement in a couple of years. Cleaning up one of the Adventure Society's rotten provincial branches gets her promoted up and out of Greenstone, putting her secrets behind her. That promotion lets her climb the ladder instead of just moving on.
Is that more or less it?
Yes, Dorgan said, darkly. Mr. Asano, let me make something clear. If you do anything to derail my daughter's ambitions, I will see you dead. Consequences be damned.
Jason held out his hand for Dorgan to shake.
I think we understand each other, Mr. Dorgan. Sharing your daughter's secret is worthless to me. Only keeping it has value.
Dorgan shook Jason's hand.
Do let me show you to the door, Mr. Asano.
Chapter 105. You aren't in control of what happens next. Sophie woke up. Unfamiliar ceiling, something around her neck. She moved, and there was a clink of chains as she realized her wrists and feet were manacled. Her body was under a soft, thin sheet. Memories came rushing back as her head cleared. The chase, getting clear, only to feel the poison eating into her. Fighting a body desperate to close its eyes, knowing they wouldn't open again. Pushing past her limits to reach the clinic and stumble in through the back. Falling onto the rack of glassware as she finally succumbed. Sitting up was awkward in the manacles, her leg irons connected to her wrist irons by a length of chain. Her eyes were crusty and blurred. She probed the thing around her neck with her fingers. A thick metal band, padded just enough to not dig into her neck, but not enough to be comfortable. It felt enervating to the touch, as if it was draining her somehow.
Power suppression collar, a male voice said. It was casual and friendly, which seemed sinister in the circumstances.
She rubbed the accumulated gunk from her eyes and looked around. She was in a white, tiled room on a padded table. There was a man in a chair in the corner, observing her from over an open book. It was that friend of Jory's, whose name she didn't remember. He used a bookmark to keep the page and shoved the book into the air, where it vanished. Dimensional storage space. She had heard he was an adventurer.
Good morning, he said. Sorry about the manacles, but you're very good at running. It was your friend who changed your clothes and cleaned you up while you were asleep. If she left any sharp implements on your person, I'd appreciate not being stabbed.
Belinda's here, she croaked.
Her mouth was gluggy.
She's upstairs, he said.
He stood up and walked over to her, plucking a glass out of thin air to offer it to her.
Juice, he told her, and she eyed the glass warily.
If I wanted to dose you with something, I had all the time in the world.
She took the glass and sipped. The juice was icy cold, sweet and delicious. She gulped down the rest and he took the glass from her hand. There was a sink in the room where he walked over and started washing out the glass.
The others wanted her to be the one here when you woke up, he said, with his back to her. But I need you to understand that you aren't in control of what happens next.
Who are you?
Darkness started rising off him like shadowy flames, engulfing him. It was like a void, with stars twinkling in the depths. She hadn't taken a good look during his pursuit and their brief fight. It was beautiful, but also gave a sense of hidden dangers. It was odd to see on a man doing the washing up.
Jason Asano, he introduced himself, and the darkness vanished again. He dried the glass with a cloth and returned it to his storage space before retaking his seat across the room.
I didn't realize who you were until the mask came off, he said, which is how I knew you'd come here, if you lived that long.
You were already recovered when I arrived, but quite thoroughly unconscious. Apparently, when you get healed up from comprehensive injury, it takes a while to sleep it off.
How did you catch Belinda?
Like you, I wasn't working alone. My friend Clive tracked her from the staging point you two set up.
She's not easy to track.
Also, like you, I'm the fast one, while my partner is the one with the know-how. I have some good news for you, though. We caught your friend out of Tharinus, not knowing who you were. But the Adventure Society contract stipulates catching a thief, not thieves. We're going to let her go.
But not me.
No, he said. You were turning in. We, that's me, my partner, and Jory, have been discussing what to do next. We need you to convince your friend Belinda not to try something reckless to get you out of this. That ship has sailed, and now the only way out is through.
So, what now?
My friend, Clive, figured out that your goal was to hit the city's spirit coin vault. He even thinks you had a chance at succeeding, which is impressive. Not a good chance, but still. I assume the point of your foolhardy scheme was to net you enough money to buy your way out from under Clarissa Ventress.
What do you know about it?
I know she put you up to these robberies, and I know why, which your friend tells me you don't.
Island politics.
Yes, he said, but it didn't start that way. Do you know who Lucian Lamprey is?
Some kind of island big shot,
Sophie said.
Likes to spend his time at the fighting pits.
Yes, he said. Your friend told me a little about your issues with Cole Silver, another member of the Big Three. You play dangerous games.
Sophie frowned. Sometimes all your options are bad. It sounds like my friend has done a lot of talking.
You and I fought 2 days ago, he told her. You've been asleep a long time, which gave me time to do some digging around.
2 days?
Yes.
Then people already know we're here. Ventress. Silver.
Dorgan, too, Jason said. The Big Three trifecta.
What's Dorgan's interest?
We'll get to that. With all the eyes on you right now, it would be best if your friend occupies Jory's guest room for a while. Between his affiliations and his recent acknowledgement by the healer, no one will try anything. Not so long as she stays.